right. Well, we are in chapter 13. Last week, we covered chapter 12, where we saw how the Lord instituted the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and that Israel left out of Egypt after the Lord brought his final plague on Egypt, killing the firstborn children of Egypt, as well as the firstborn animals. And just as the Lord predicted, it's as the Lord had told Moses and the Israelites, the Egyptians literally like pushed them out. They said, "Get out of here! You know, we've had enough." And they could see that, if they didn't give in, that who knows what would come next. And so we see the Jews going out of the land, and it brings us here to chapter 13. And so we will start there in chapter 13, and we'll read a few verses and talk about it. So chapter 13 of Exodus, verse 1 reads, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Consecrate to me all the firstborn, whatever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and beast, it is mine.'" And so we see here in these first two verses, the Lord speaking to Moses and telling him to tell all the people that the firstborn is to be consecrated or set aside for him. And what's really going on there is that this is something that is being done in remembrance of what the Lord did, in remembrance of the destruction of the firstborn of Egypt, both man and beast, and how the Lord delivered Israel from that. He delivered them not only from their bondage of slavery, but he also kept them from suffering the judgment of having their firstborn children and beasts killed by the Lord. And so basically the Lord is saying that those your firstborn children, both man and beast, belong to me. Though they belong to me. And as I look at this, it really, to me, what this speaks of is that, all throughout the Word of God, it talks about how, the firstborn child represents the strength. It represents something really special in a family, that firstborn. And also the firstborn of your livestock or the things that you have, the things that, that firstborn beast, it represents something that is the best. And so as I look at this, we can take from this is that we are to give our best to the Lord. We are to give our strength. We are to give, the kinds of things that come to mind in that regard are, you think about your life, you come to Christ, and Lord willing, we come to Christ at a young age, and we have, our whole life ahead of us. We have, our youth, our strength, and so the Lord would be saying, I brought you out of slavery. I brought you out of the land of Egypt, which represents the world. And slavery, which means, being bound to a life of sin. And so the Lord would be saying that, your strength, your first, your best, that belongs to me. You are to consecrate that and give that to me. It is mine. Because if you were to remain in slavery, so think about the Israelites, if they had stayed in slavery in Egypt, all of their firstborn would be, their lives would be wasted. It would be used for the pleasure of their master, of Pharaoh, of the ones who were their taskmasters. And so in essence, it would be as though their firstborn wouldn't be alive at all, because they wouldn't be able to live out their life. They wouldn't be able to serve the Lord or do anything for that matter. And so the same can be said for us. If the Lord just allowed us to just stay in that life of sin and just live that way, our lives would be wasted. There would not be any real value to our lives. And so it makes sense that we would consecrate our best and give that over to the Lord. And so moving on into verse 3, it says, "And Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand, the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day, you are going out in the month of Abib, and it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month." And so we talked last time about the Feast of Unleavened Bread and how it comes, you know, right after the Passover, essentially those two feasts are really linked together. And we talked a little bit about what the Feast of Unleavened Bread represented. I want to talk a little bit more about that right now. So first of all, bread is a type of Christ, right? It's a type of Jesus. And in the New Testament and in the Gospels, Jesus said, "I am the bread that has come down from God out of heaven. If any man eat of me, he shall live forever." And so that is, so when they're eating this bread, again, through all of this typology and symbolism, this bread, it represents Christ. But because it represents Christ, it's a type of Christ, it could not have any leaven in it because Jesus was without sin. So we talked about leaven a little bit, that it was, we all know that leaven is yeast, right? It's used to cause the dough of bread to rise. And it does this through a rotting process, okay? And the oxygen that is released in that rotting process, that's what causes the bread to rise. And we can see throughout the scriptures, you know, it talks from time to time about leaven, and it talks about how it is kind of a type of sin. And the reason why is because, you know, just a little bit of it, right? If you take a little bit of that yeast and you put it into a lump of dough, and it will permeate, it'll go throughout the whole thing. In fact, the way that they would kind of preserve this yeast, people do it today as well, is, you know, you make a lump of dough and you put the yeast in there. And so now you have something. But what they do is when they make the bread, they'll save part of it to be a starter. And so then when they go ahead and make another a batch of dough, all they have to do is put that little bit of that starter into that dough, and it will permeate and spread throughout all of that that dough and cause it to rise. And so it is very much, it is a very good type or symbol of sin, because it's the same way that sin is in our lives, is that a little bit of sin that, like, if we tolerate even the smallest amount of sin in our lives, it has a way of spreading and bringing rottenness into our lives. And so that is sort of one of the things that the Lord, you know, we talked about last time, that the Lord, you know, used the Jews to kind of act out, you know, all these different things that were pointing to him. And so one of the things, you know, also sort of to bring these various symbols forward, we also see how Jesus used the symbols of the Passover in the New Testament, right? And that would be with regard to communion, okay? On that day when Jesus and his disciples were having the Last Supper, the Lord took bread and he said to them, you know, this is my body, which is broken for you. And he took the Passover cup that had wine there, and he said, this is my blood, a new covenant in my blood, which is shed for the remission of sins. And so he was able to take those symbols and make and show how they applied to himself, how God has delivered us from the bondage of sin. And then he said to them, as often as you eat of the bread and drink of the cup, you show forth the Lord's death until he comes again. And he said, do this in remembrance of me. And so we see here that the Lord, that is one of the things that the Lord told the Jews back in these times, and he's telling us today, it's the same thing. It's a very important thing to remember. We're very quick to forget about what the Lord has done in our lives, where the Lord has brought us from, and so forth. But the Lord wants that to always be in our minds. And so he says to them that, you know, this time when the Lord established this Passover, we saw this back in chapter 12, it was in the month of Abib, and that month is essentially the month of April. This month was later called Nisan in Nehemiah and Esther. But that is the beginning of their religious calendar. And we talked about that being the significance being like, this is the beginning of your new life, you know, after the Lord has delivered you. And so he says, and it shall be in verse 5, I like what it says here, you know, and it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. The Lord always speaks emphatically, you know, this is going, it's going to happen. You know, it's not like he says, you know, it shall be like, you know, if you make it, you know, if you happen to make it there or something, you know, there's nothing equivocal about it. Nothing where it's like, you know, maybe you will, maybe you won't. He's saying, I'm going to bring you into this land, verse 5, which he swore to your fathers to give to you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service. So he's saying, keep this service. And what is this service? 7 days you shall eat this unleavened bread. And on the seventh day, there shall be a feast unto the Lord. Verse 7, unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be among you in all of your quarters. And we talked about that all of this about unleavened bread and everything else, it was really pointing to the fact that, you know, when the Lord set us free, when he delivers us, he doesn't deliver us just to live any kind of life. He delivers us to live a sin-free life. That's the life we are endeavoring to live, is a life that is free from sin. And so that's why this 7 days of eating this unleavened bread, you know, 7 days is a number in the Bible that represents completeness. And so it's like, it's to say that this is something that you are that's going to characterize your entire life, basically, that you are to seek to live a life that is without sin. Verse 8, and you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt. And, you know, again, we talked about this before, too, that it's a very important thing that the Lord requires of us, that not that we just live our lives out with our relationship with the Lord, but we are to pass this along. We are to tell our children about this. And we are to do these things in front of them. We're not to go, you know, hide and do them, or say, oh, we're doing adult things. You know, you guys go over here and play. But he wants for them to do everything, all of their service before their children so that they can see it, and it will make them curious and make them ask, and they can tell them about it. And so the same can be said for us, that we are to do our service. We are to worship the Lord and before our children so that they can see us. We should pray before them. We should sing before them. We should read our Bibles before them so that they can see all these things happening. And, I often think about, when you go through the book of Genesis, and if you think about, at the very beginning, you have Adam and Eve, and they were talking directly to the Lord, and as their children were born, they knew about Adam and Eve and about everything that took place. But it does make you wonder, what happened? How is it that there ended up being people who were pagans, people who were worshiping false gods and stuff? Well, as people spread out throughout the earth, there were people that became rebellious, and they either became rebellious or they became complacent, where they just didn't tell their children about the true and the living God. And then over time, over many, many generations, you end up with a set of people who don't know the true and the living God. And so this is a really important thing that we tell our children. And as I said last week, we shouldn't take that attitude that would be like, let them learn themselves. We ought to let them, come to these conclusions. And that's not what we're to do. And we don't do that with regard to anything else, right? We don't just say, let me just let my kid figure out how to tie their shoes, or let me just let them create their own language, or figure out mathematics, or technology, or whatever the case may be. We take all the things that we learn and we pass those along, including like mistakes that we've made and everything else. And so this is the most important thing. And so we are to tell our children about the Lord and all the great things that he's done for us, because otherwise, how would they know? Verse 9, it says, it shall be a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth, for with a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. And so here we see a few things. One is this sentence here about it being a sign on their hand and a memorial between their eyes. And I see this as the Lord saying that, that in our remembrance and in their remembrance, it's supposed to be, top of mind. It's supposed to be, involved in everything that they do and everything that they think, that they should never let that memory of what the Lord did leave them. And, many people believe that that this verse is what led to the Jews having these things called phylacteries. And so even in the time of Christ, you know, before the Pharisees and the Sadducees and whatnot, they would have these boxes that they would put on their foreheads, and, you know, they would tie around their foreheads and they would put them on their wrists. And inside these boxes, they would have scripture, you know, rolled up tight and put in there. So they took this literally, and they did this. The key is that the Lord, in reality, it's not like the Lord just wanted people walking around with these things on their foreheads and on their arms. He literally wanted that to be in their minds and involved in everything that they did. Ultimately, what he wanted was the next clause where it says that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. You know, so that's what he really wanted. And, you know, the modern day version of this is, in my mind, is, you know, when the Lord says that, you know, when in Paul, you know, talked about how we should speak to each other in psalms and hymns, and we should sing and make melody in our hearts to God. And, you know, that's the real idea, is that the Lord is always on our minds, and we're always thinking about the great things that the Lord has done, and we're talking about the great things that the Lord has done. And actually, I'm going to read that verse because I butchered it. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 19 and 20 are the verses. I call that the New Testament version of this. And my it's just my viewpoint. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 19 says, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. That's that would be for us, right? That's the, you know, how we should be living our lives. And so it's very similar to what the Lord is telling them here in chapter 13 of Exodus. Verse 10 says, you shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. And it shall be when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers and gives it to you, that you shall set apart to the Lord all that open the womb, that is every firstborn that comes from an animal which you have, the males shall be the Lord's. And so what is being communicated here in verses 11 and 12 is, you know, two things. One is, again, the Lord speaking very emphatically about the fact that he is going to bring them into the land. But secondly, it this goes to what the Lord had said in verse 2 about setting apart or consecrating to him all of the firstborn children of Israel, both man and beast, that they are to take the firstborn animals and they are to separate them away from the other ones. And because they belong to the Lord, and they are to be used in his service. And I, as I look at this, I see they had to operate based upon faith here, right? Because they're taking the you know, livestock in these times, remember, it represents their livelihood. This would determine, you know, how wealthy you are, right? And so they're basically taking the best, right? And they're saying, this belongs to the Lord. And they're having to have faith in God that even though they're giving that over to the Lord, that the Lord is going to provide for them, that the Lord is going to make sure that they have everything that they need. It doesn't make logical sense. Logically, you'd say, who would do that? I mean, that's the best. And you may need that. You may need that livestock. You may need that for food or whatever the case is, right? But the Lord says, no, this is what you're to do. And if, you know, and it requires faith. Verse 13, it goes on to say, but every firstborn donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you will not redeem it, then you shall break its neck, and all the firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And so the question is, what's going on here about this donkey and breaking its neck and everything else? Well, a donkey is an unclean animal, but it's a very valuable animal, okay? And so the point is that for the firstborn of a donkey, this unclean animal, they couldn't offer that as a sacrifice to the Lord because it's unclean. And so it, therefore it wouldn't be a proper sacrifice. And so what the Lord is communicating is that unless this donkey is redeemed, it could not be retained, or, you know, it could not be kept by the owner, nor could it be used by its owner. Your only choice is that you are to kill it by breaking its neck. You couldn't kill it by slaughtering it, because then it would shed blood, and it would be as if it were a sacrifice. It would be an implied sacrifice, which would not be acceptable. And so they had to make the choice between taking this valuable animal. And I say it's valuable because it could be used for transportation. It's like, it'd be like taking a car and you know, wrecking it, right? And also could be used in their farming and so forth, right? Donkey is very, very valuable. So they either had to redeem it using a lamb, or they had to break its neck. Now that was their choice. Verse 14, it says, so it shall be when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this that you say to him, by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So again, it's about the testimony of what the Lord has done. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord all males that open the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. And it shall be as a sign on your hand and as frontlets between your eyes, for by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt. Verse 17, then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. And so here we see some interesting things. I don't have a map, but when they left out of Egypt, they could have gone sort of up, and it's a very short route from Egypt directly into Canaan. But the Lord led them more in a kind of a downward direction. And it's saying here that he did so for a reason. And one of the reasons is that in that route going upwards along the coast, there were two different things that would potentially oppose the Jews. One is that they had Egyptian garrisons. There were basically troops there that would be, you know, guarding and watching out for nations that would be trying to come into Egypt to make war with them. But as specifically mentioned here, there were also the Philistines, who were the most powerful of the nations that inhabited the land of Canaan. And so God says here is that he did not want to take them that direction, because then they would have had to get into a battle. And the bottom line is that they weren't ready for that battle. They weren't ready to fight that war against the Philistines or to come into contact with the Egyptians. And so it would make them want to return. And so, you know, how could we sort of relate that to us today, right? And that is to say that the Lord does not allow us to come into any kind of a tribulation or a temptation that we're not ready for, you know, a battle, like a spiritual battle that we're not ready for. He will first make sure that we are ready to do that. And so it says here in verse 18 that God led the people around, okay? And that gave them time for the nation to gradually become accustomed to the various hardships, you know, that are involved in a long journey in the desert. They learned to be obedient to their chief, you know, to Moses. And they also, over time, became trained in military discipline through battle with weaker tribes in the desert. And so we see that the Lord had in his plan a period of time that they would be in the wilderness, and they would actually be strengthened. They would develop some things that would help them to be able to deal with different kinds of battles. But one of the things that I want to point out, and we're going to see more as we continue on through Exodus and the books that follow, is that there was a legitimate wilderness experience that the Lord had for the Jews, okay? And you can see it here, that the Lord, he purposefully had them go on this longer route. He had them go through the wilderness. And the reason why is because before bringing them into the land that he promised, into this rich land, this rich life that the Lord had promised, he wanted them to actually go through some things and to be able to see God. I mean, so in other words, he wanted to continue to show himself to them, to show his nature to them, to show them his character, and to have their faith be built up that way. And so there was, like I said, there's a legitimate period of time that the Lord will do that in our lives, right? To have this sort of legitimate wilderness experience. But there also can be an illegitimate experience. And we're going to see that the Jews ended up being in the wilderness for 40 years, okay? But the Lord only, the Lord likely had planned for them just to be there for the time that it takes to go, which would be like, you know, a few weeks to go through. Okay, but because when they were at Kadesh Barnea and they failed to go into the land, then God said to them, you're going to roam around in this wilderness until this generation passes away. And so they ended up in this sort of illegitimate wilderness experience. And that, you know, really does highlight a really important point that is applicable to us as Christians today. Unfortunately, you know, we as Christians could also go through a illegitimate wilderness experience. So yes, there is supposed to be a time when we go through the wilderness where we are strengthened, we encounter different like mini battles, and we get to see the Lord working and so forth. But there are some people who end up just in that all their lives. They're just failing. They're having points and times where, you know, their strength, you know, they feel really good. They feel strong in their faith. They're doing God's will, and then they fall, and they, you know, and then you get back up, and then you just keep going around in circles, around and around and around. But that's not the way that the Lord intends for our lives to be. He intends for us to go into the land that He has provided for us. And so I want to take just a moment here and just talk. I was going to talk about this before. There was one study when I was going to get into this, but I ran out of time. And this has to do with just the typology that's going on in Exodus. And I want to take a little bit of time to kind of give a bigger picture of that. So that we can see, you know, what the Lord was doing with them and how He was painting a picture that we can look back upon and see. Okay. And so what is it? So there are all these different things that we've talked about, how Egypt itself is a type of the life of sin. It is a symbol of being in the world. Okay, and it is a life of oppression and bondage. It is the life of the flesh. And so this would represent the life that we had before we came to Christ. Okay, this life of being in the world. And Pharaoh, we said, is the type of Satan who is seeking to hold us in the life of bondage. Okay. And not let us come out of that life in the world, that life of sin. The Red Sea, which we're going to cover in the next chapter, would represent, it's a type or is a symbol of water baptism, okay? And coming out of the wilderness and it is the type of the new experience and relationship with God. And so it is to represent that time when we would be acknowledging that we have been separated fully from the old life. That life is behind us and it's gone. And we are now entering into the new relationship with God. Okay, where we are trusting in Him, we are walking in Him by faith, and we were learning the faithfulness of God. Then there is the Jordan River, right? And that is the type of death to the old man, the death of the old nature. And so to get from the wilderness into the promised land, you need to cross that Jordan River. And so this is what the Jordan represents. And then the promised land, it represents the type of reckoning the old man or the old nature to be dead and recognizing that we are crucified with Christ and we are beginning to walk fully in the Spirit. So it's walking in the Spirit. And then we begin to appropriate into our lives all that God has promised to us. And that's why, you know, we're going to see where the Lord says that everywhere that you put your step, you know, the Lord has given it to us. And so we're looking to claim all that richness of life that the Lord has provided to us by Jesus and His death on the cross. And so we're going to see that you know, they get out into the wilderness, they get through the Red Sea, but then there's a swirl. They just keep going around in circles, and so they end up not you know, moving to the next stage that the Lord wants them to move to in time. And so again, the Lord, you know, is allowing, you know, all this to happen. These are all examples. Some of the examples that the Jews provide in the Old Testament are good examples for us, and others are examples of things that we want to avoid. And so let's continue on back here in Exodus chapter 13. We'll look at verse 19. It says, "And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, 'God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you.'" And we read about that in Genesis, where Joseph made them swear that they would take his bones with them. And so we see this occurring. And everything that Joseph prophesied here occurred. God did surely visit them, and then they did carry his bones. Verse 20, "So they took their journey from Succoth and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness, and the Lord went before them in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so as to go by day and night." And so we see here the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. That represented the presence of the Lord. And so we can see there in verse 22, it says, "He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people." And so this represented God's presence, to have this cloud and this pillar. It also represented God's leading, because where that cloud went, that was telling them that's where they're to go. And so the Lord was leading them that way. He's providing light to them. He was lighting their way with the pillar of fire. And we're going to see that the cloud also provided a covering. So when they were in the desert in this extreme heat, it's providing a covering, and it was providing protection. And so this really demonstrates, it is really a symbol of how the Lord is with us, you know, where Jesus says, you know, "I will never leave you or forsake you." The Lord is always with us. He's there to provide a leading to us. He's there to provide a covering for us. He's there to provide protection for us. He's there to light the way for us. And so it's a beautiful picture of God's presence in our lives. And again, verse 22, it really demonstrates that. It says here that the entire time they were in the wilderness, even the whole 40 years, that, you know, the Lord did not take away the pillar of fire and the cloud. That's to say that his presence was always with them, always. He never left them. And so that's an amazing, wonderful thing that took place. Let's read a few verses in chapter 14, and then we will we'll stop. Chapter 14, verse 1 says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi Hath Iroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart, so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all of his enemy, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord.' And they did so." So there's a few things here that are very significant. Number one, we see here that, I mean, if you were just reading this and you're just kind of, you know, taking this as it unfolds, it may not be apparent, but one of the things that I must point out here is the Lord is leading them into a place where they're going to be cornered. Okay, so he's going to put them in a place where behind them is the Red Sea, and in front of them, you know, they're kind of like in a cul-de-sac, you might say, in a sense that they're sitting ducks. But make no mistake about it, the Lord intentionally put them in this situation. And so we have to look at this and understand that the Lord, he does do that. He does put us into situations that can be like this situation, but he did it for a purpose. The bottom line is, the Lord wasn't done with Egypt or with Israel. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is that, you know, we talked about, you know, early on in Egypt, I mean, in Exodus, when Pharaoh said, like, who is the Lord that I should obey him and everything else, that the Lord was going to show him, you know, who he was. And he certainly did with all these 10 plagues, right? The Lord made it very clear who he was and how powerful he was, how he was more powerful than all of their false gods and everything else. And you would think that that was enough. But we can see here that it says that, you know, the Lord is telling Moses that Pharaoh his heart is getting, the Lord is going to harden his heart so that he's going to pursue them, you know, instead of just letting him go and taking his losses, he's going to make one last attempt to come after them. And so the Lord has them go into this place where it seems like they're cornered. And so that Pharaoh would say, well, look at these guys. They don't even know what they're doing. These slaves, they're bewildered by the land. They don't know the land. And they put themselves where they're closed in. I got them. They're right where I want them. I'm going to go and I'm going to destroy them. Right. But we see in verse 4 that the Lord did this for a reason. One, he says that I will gain honor over Pharaoh and his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. So he did this on purpose so that they would once and for all, the Egyptians would see the greatness of God. And likewise, the Jews themselves, who are going to see what the Lord's going to do, they also are going to again, have the Lord and his greatness be unfolded to them. Verse 5, it says, now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? And so now there's like the regret. He's like, what do? We shouldn't have let them go out like that. All those people, we need those people to work. We got to do something about it. And so verse 6, it says, so we made ready his chariot and took his people with him. And so this chariot, they're going to come, and it says here in verse 7, and he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt, with captains over every one of them. This is a great show of force. A chariot would be like a tank, you know. It's a very powerful weapon of war, used in warfare. And so he's got 600 choice chariots and all of these warriors that are going to come out after the Jews here. Verse 8, and the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, camping by the sea beside Pi-Hath-Roth before Baal-Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Yes. Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians that we die in the wilderness? And so we see here that here they are, they're cornered, the Egyptians are upon them, and they just say like, what, you know, they just lose heart, you know, all the children of Israel, they just say like, what did you do? Like, weren't there enough graves in Egypt? Couldn't we just have stayed there and died? Why would you have to, you know, take me out into the wilderness to die? You know, all this, you know, walking and everything. I could have just stayed at home if I was just going to die, basically. And you say, remember when we came, when you talked to us and we said like, just let us serve, let us, you know, stay here. It's fine. We're good. And so they're basically, this is a pattern, you know, they're going to be doing this all the time, murmuring and complaining against Moses. So this is just the beginning, but here they're in a really precarious position. Again, this is a position the Lord put them in, okay? And so we're going to stop here. And next week, we're going to pick up where we left off, and we're going to see how the Lord rescues them out of this situation. And there'll be many things that we will learn from that would be applicable to our lives today. So we'll stop right there, and we'll pick up where we left off.